Okay. I apologize. I'm now looking for more light. I have pneumonia and I am at home. Okay. As opposed to where I normally stay on Wednesdays. Okay. Hello. Okay. Apologies again. Okay, let's start then. Good evening on your side of the ocean. Okay. And I want to deal with Hukim. So that takes us beyond our first two shurim, which I will try to quickly refer to, and then move on. Okay, I'm with us now. Hello again. Our first two shurim dealt with the issue of, is halacha formalist or is it not formalist? In dealing with, is halacha formalist or is halacha not formalist, we basically dealt with two questions. Is halacha merely an attempt to, merely, but is it merely an attempt to loyally, if you will, apply norms, halachot, laws, precedents, you know, gemaras, mishnayot, shuvot, or is it an attempt to actually apply them to real life? And by apply them to real life, that would mean apply the underlying concerns of the precedents to real life. So to go in reverse order, which might be somewhat theologically or ideologically easier, we saw, for example, that Rishon will look at a Gemara, such as Rabbi Tam did as regards Hidut, and Rishon will say, well, we can't actually limit our edut or testimony to merely moral, oral testimony, edut shebal peh, because we have a mercantile society made up of merchants who travel from city to city and meet at fairs and do business at the fairs, and there's no way we'll get both merchants and witnesses together in person easily. And so, I was just lost. Can you hear me? Oh, one second, I'm finding out what happened. Just okay, if you can hear me, I'm continuing. Here we go. And so what happens is we accept the testimony in writing, but we accept the testimony in writing, but we require that the testimony be potentially oral. So for those who recall that shir, hope that was definitely clear. And for those who don't recall this year, the point is the Torah and Chazal at least required that the testimony be oral, and Rabbeinu Tam understood the testimony be at least potentially oral in his society, where it didn't make sense to limit edut to being merely oral. If we turn to an earlier, possibly more difficult example ideologically, it was Rambam who said, "True, a get can only be believed if it was witnessed by two trustworthy witnesses. Otherwise, if it's witnessed by two completely untrustworthy witnesses, we have no way of knowing that it's a true get. That's not a forged event and a forged document." But given the case that he dealt with, which was a case in which the whole community knew that the woman had actually been divorced with a document, just that the witnesses weren't trustworthy, which means that there's no way the rest of the jury would ever know that she had actually been divorced, Rambam was willing to say that let her be considered divorced as long as her husband writes her a new get, something which legally, by formal halakha, midrashah should not work. But given the contextual situation, And given that Rambam met the concerns for the future, which is that future gittin will have to be written and signed, by valid witnesses, because Rambam warned the community to do that, because Rambam told the community to write a new get. Given that this woman will be able to prove in the future that she was divorced, even to other Jews, in other communities should she move, because she would have a new get. Rambam said, let it slide. It's acceptable. She is considered divorced and not considered an adulteress who married a new man and had mamzerim with the new man. So for those who are here, I hope that's clear. If there are any people who were not here for those two shirim, you can ask me questions very shortly, very briefly now, and I will try to be clear and move on. Okay. So let's move on to chukim. What happened on the basis of these two shirim is that I believe it was Shana who asked, legitimately. If everything can make sense in that way and everything can be unpacked, what about chukim? So, as regards chukim, what I'll do tonight is I will discuss chukim and try to show that they are actually explicable. And then, I believe it was, I don't remember now, whether it was Eric or David, who asked me to, who asked me to put up more sources when I refer to other issues. And what I will do is, after Shir, I will try to put online my discussion of why Chukim became called Chukim, something that I believe occurred during the Byzantium period, when Jews were under the rule of Christian Romans. But let's not jump ahead. Let me first try to show that Chukim are explicable. Okay, so let's start with Bamidbar, classic Chok, dealing with a myth. Okay, so as you see in front of you, we have the Parsha. I believe I've been reading in English until now, right? For the sake of all participants. So, let's turn to the English. This is a law that applies when a person dies in a tent. Anyone who enters a tent, anyone who is in it, will be unclean for 7 days. Every open container without a lid fastened on it will be unclean. Let's pause on that. We'll skip that for a moment. Anyone out in the open who touches someone who has been killed with a sword, or someone who has died a natural death, or anyone who touches a human bone or a grave, will be unclean for 7 days. Okay, let's pause here. Somebody who is present in the house where a person is dead, or somebody who touches a dead person, or somebody who touches the bone of a dead person, is considered unclean for 7 days. Now, if we put aside any preconceptions about Tuma, we have here a halakha that says anybody who touches a dead person, is in the house of the dead person, is in some type of negative state for 7 days. Well, let me suggest, and bear with me a moment as I will show this through Chazal, that being unclean means being in a psychological negative state. So Tuma is a psychological negative state. So they're not always identical negative states. For example, I might touch a dead cheret, a dead Hebrew curly, let's say, and I will be Tamei in one way, meaning Tamei in the sense of disgusting, and I might deal with having been in the house with death, and especially in the classic sense, which is that I'm in a house with the death of somebody that is related to me, or I'm in a house in the death of somebody suddenly that I stumble upon, or somebody that I may have killed in war, right, with a sword. In only those cases, I will be impure, and that's a very different type of reaction than being impure because I merely touched something disgusting. Or, to borrow Chazal's terms, which do not appear on this page, the most severe form of tuma, of impurity, is impurity from contact with a dead person. It's not merely an avatuma, It's an avi avot atuma. It is the grandfather of all tumot. It is the most severe form of tumot. So let's see that this is actually a psychological phenomenon by turning to sources. Tanya, Rabbi Shimon ben Chayomer, Kivrehen shel achrim ein mitamim. Atem kuyin adam, ein achrim kuyin adam. We turn to see Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says that the graves of non-Jews do not impurify. Their bodies do, but the graves don't. Why? Because you are called people, and Gentiles are not called people. Now, this is obviously not rhetorical, but a statement that is somewhat exaggerated. Because the body of a dead person does impurify. Why is the body of a dead person impurified? Because I touch the body of a dead person, I stand over the body of a dead person, or I'm in the house of the body of a dead person, I'm facing death. But, on the other hand, the Gentile is considered, according to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, alien, of a different culture, not of the same group. In a sense, not Adam, when it comes to the grave. So let me just try to give an example that might work. Let us say that I am traveling the world. I come across an ancient cemetery, especially the European American model with grass and so forth. And I walk through. Now, if it's just a foreign ancient cemetery, I may be very moved by the ancient site. I may be moved by the fact that history is revealed in front of me. By the fact that humans existed, the human condition. I may be moved by many things, but I'll probably not walk out very emotionally troubled by the fact that I encountered death. As opposed to if I walk into a cemetery, especially if it is, again, a cemetery with those with whom I identify. So, for example, I go to a funeral in Israel, but let's say I went to the funeral in Israel, not to a funeral, I just went to the cemetery, and I didn't go to the grave of somebody I knew directly, but I went to the grave of people, and I started looking at their names, and I realized that either I know some of these people in some way, I've heard of them, or their names sound similar to people that I know, they resonate with me, and they're part of the same culture. In other words, I become Tameh. So Shimon ben Yochai claims, if I enter the cemetery or walk over the graves of people that are connected to me, Adam, then I become Tameh. Otherwise, I do not become Tameh. I know that's one read. One could disagree with what I just said. So let's move on to a Mishnah. Amalan Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, this is a Mishnah with Prushim debating with Sukim. Amalan Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Prushim omrim, atzamot chamor tzorim. Atzamot yochanan gadol tzmeim. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in the course of discussing some issues with the Prushim, with the Tzidukim, I'm sorry, says, look, the Prushim's argument is, he is Prushim himself, Pharisee, that the bones of the donkey are pure, while the bones of the high priest Yochanan, according to Gadol Yochanan, are Tzmeim. Amar Lehem, and he explains, V'fi chibatan hi tumatan, that depending on the degree of affection, that was in English, Tum'ah, impurity, depends on the degree of affection. Now, I think this is an even much clearer statement. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, look, I look at a carcass of, not a carcass, that would be disgusting with flies, and that would be tamei due to disgust. I look at a skeleton of a donkey, a dry skeleton. I drive through Death Valley, and I see a skeleton of some animal. I don't become tamei. However, if I see a skeleton of Yochanan Kohen Gadol, right, or anybody that is truly meaningful to me, right, I will become tamei. Why? The fi chivatan hi tumatan. Impurity depends on the degree of affection. So I think here we have a much clearer statement, and that matches the previous braita, that impurity is actually a psychological reaction. So, having said that, I want to now argue that if that's the case, it turns out that, if you go back to the Midbar moment, or think about the Midbar, this is not a chok. in the sense that this is not something that cannot be understood. And even more importantly, I'll now add a new criterion. We know it's halachot not merely because it can be understood. It's halachot because it is actually played out in different ways over time. Meaning, if something is a chok, and you say it's a sui generis law, a law that has no purpose that we can understand, then we would expect it to be played out in only one form, the form found in the Torah, and not played out further over time in different forms under different conditions. And we find the opposite. We find that the halacha of the Torah is played out later with slight differences from the Torah, but with the same function, playing the same role. So let's finish the Torah's halacha here, and then see how it plays out in Chazal's world. So if we continue the Torah here, we're now in Pasuk Yud Tetzayim. Okay, for the unclean person, put some ashes from the burned purification of offering, into a jar and pour fresh water over them. I'll come back to Parah Adumah later. But right now, fresh water, Mayim Chayim, is poured over these ashes. And the man who is ceremonially clean, that's the JPS translation, is to take some hyssop, dip it in the water, and sprinkle the tent and all the furnishings and the people who were there. He must also sprinkle anyone who has touched a human bone or a grave or someone who has been killed or someone who has died a natural death. So he sprinkled everything with fresh water. Mayim Chayim is fresh water. Actually, Mayim Chayim in Tanakh is not merely fresh water, it is spring water. So a person who is Tameh is sprinkled with cold spring water. The man who is clean is to sprinkle the unclean person on the third and seventh days. Twice during the week. Third day after death, or after contact with death, and the seventh day. Now on the seventh day is to purify him. The person being cleansed must wash his clothes and bathe with water, and that evening he will be clean. So after the person has been sprinkled with cold water, that person then bathes himself further, washes his clothing, and is clean in the evening. What I would suggest is that this is a process of dealing with the psychological stages of impurity, of mourning or reaction to death. In other words, on the first 2 days, the person is allowed to simply mourn. Community does not intervene in a major way. The third day, the Kohen comes in and says, with no words, not verbally, but sprinkles with cold water, indicating that there is a process now of mourning and yet beginning to move forward. On the seventh day, the Kohen comes and sprinkles again, which is the indicator that it is now time to end the process. And the person then bathes him or herself and ends the process. I'll try to show that this is the case by turning to the Chazal, that they actually understood it in this fashion, even as they played it out somewhat differently without Kohanim and without Parah Adumah and cold water. Again, I will return to Parah Adumah. So let's turn to Masechet Tzemachot. Masechet Tzemachot is edited in the period of the Gaonim, but it includes earlier Tanaitic material. On the first and second day, the Avel, right, the mourner, does not enter the Har Habayit. Okay, I will use Hebrew times, assuming that people follow. Does not enter the Temple Mount. On the third day, however, he would enter, but he would enter and walk across the mount in the opposite direction of the normal human traffic flow. As it goes on to describe there, what that means is that anybody seeing this person cross the Temple Mount would now realize that this person is a mourner. So, we now have a model in which for 2 days the person remains at home and mourns. On the third day the person leaves the house, enters the most public area of Yerushalayim, crosses the Temple Mount, is met by everybody. Everybody then acknowledges the person, or further sources than he gave you, acknowledges the person, offers comfort to the person on this third day. And they all either know the person, I'm sure some arranged to come to the Temple Mount when he did, or she did, but he did probably. But Others wouldn't have necessarily arranged it, but they would realize it was that he is a mourner, and they would respond accordingly. And then the person would return home and continue mourning. Or, in the words of a Braita in Moed Katan, Shoshaya Milabechi, 3 days are for crying. Vishiva Lespe, and 7 days are for eulogizing. Not eulogizing publicly in the sense of standing up in shul or eulogizing, rather eulogizing in the sense of talking about the dead person. So 3 days are for crying, 7 days are for eulogizing, Shloshim, 30 are for Yehutz V'Tisporet, washing clothes and grooming, meaning not to wash clothes and not to groom oneself. So for 3 days, one basically cries. First 3 days are the most intense days. Somewhere on that third day, a shift would occur, at least according to Smachot and according to the Torah in Bamidbar. The rest of the week would be to continue talking about the dead person. And the rest of the month would be a form of mourning in which one would limit taking care of oneself. One would bathe in cold water. This is not Ashkenaz, this is Tilch Chazal. So one would bathe in cold water, but one would, after the week, but one would not wash clothes and Yehutz wash clothes. One would not wash clothes well. Yehutz is washing them very well, the type of washing that should be done on Chol HaMoed and so forth. And Tisporet, and one would not groom oneself, take a haircut. So, if we look at this, this is actually, in a sense, the Tzukim, right? 3 days and 7 days. At the end of 7 days, the person is allowed to bathe again. They would bathe, similar to the Torah saying, after 7 days, the mourner bathes. It's a break, it's a liminal move from the week where one just wasn't willing to take care of one's body. One was meant to be, at least not be willing to take care of one's body. One was meant to be mourning. One was meant to be reacting. One was meant to be tamei avel. And then, after 7 days, or on the seventh day itself, similar to on the third day, one would then bathe, as was still done, or would still be done by non-Ashkenazim, and then one would keep a lower profile mourning period for the rest of the 30 days. So, if I were to pause here, we would see two things so far. We would see that Avilut, in the sense of the Torah sense of Avilut, 3 days and 7 days, was maintained throughout. We would see that the sense of the community approaching the person and saying, move, be ready to move on from 3 days to the end of the week, which is 7 days, occurs, whether it's by the Kohen coming to the person's house or by the person entering Har HaBayit. And even bathing, we find exists, because bathing in the Torah is on the seventh day, and bathing for Chazal is also on the seventh day. So we see all these parallels. One question that one could raise is, well, that's all beautiful, but what happened to Pradyuma? I kind of sidestepped, if you will, the elephant in the room, I believe that's the phrase in English. I sidestepped it and did not speak about the actual ashes of a Pradyuma. So before I speak about the actual ashes of Pradyuma, I want to look at one more source, it's a sefer. Amru. HaPesach nechal b'tumah b'zman sh'rov shel tzibur tzmeim. Where am I again? B'zman sh'rov shel tzibur tzmeim. Right, the Pesach can be in, the Pesach sacrifice, the Passover sacrifice can be in when most of the congregation is tamei, is impure. B'zman sh'Pesach nechal b'tumah, when it is in impurity, tamemet nechas la'azara b'shochet. But not only can it be eaten in impurity, but rather somebody who is impure because of contact with the dead can even enter not merely the Temple Mount, but actual Temple Courtyard and Shech. What happened on Erev Pesach is that every group of people that would eat a Korban Pesach, a sacrifice, a family or more, or two families, would send one representative into the courtyard who would then Shech the animal. So the Kohanim did not merely gather all the animals and then shecht them, slaughter them, and distribute them back to the families. Rather, a representative of a group would enter, slaughter the animal, and then the animals would be taken back to the group to eat. So in that case, where most of the congregation is, in fact, impure, most of the congregation is impure, actually, from the dead, that's the context, then they are allowed to eat the Pesach sacrifice, and in fact, they do not have to find somebody who is not impure from the dead to slaughter it for them. Rather, they send one of their own inside, into the courtyard, to slaughter the animal, and that one of their own can be a person who is impure from the dead. Means we have the concept of discussing a scenario in which most of the Jewish people are impure from the dead and are sending in one of their own to slaughter the animal. What are we dealing with? Why are most of the Jewish people impure from the dead? What if the claim that Tosefta is dealing with in an anomalous situation? Pesach falls out right after a war of some sort, even though war is normally into the spring and summer, not early when the roads and highways are still muddy. But classically, what war was held later. But one could offer that suggestion. I want to offer, I think, a simpler and more radical suggestion, which is we are dealing already with Jews who are no longer purifying themselves with the ashes of a paraduma, of a red heifer. And since they're no longer purifying themselves with the ashes of a red heifer, the question arises, well, how can they enter the temple? So they can enter the Temple Mount if they have bathed themselves. That we already noticed for those people who decided to go into the Temple Mount on the third day. But how could these people actually enter the Azara, the courtyard, or how could they actually eat a Korban Pesach? And the Tosefta responds that in a culture in which most people no longer, if you will, bother using the ashes of a red heifer, they are, in their own eyes, from their own experiential perspective, pure. They don't keep walking around carrying the weight of death in the way of a person who is within the first week, or even of a person who is past the first week or refuses to bathe and move on. That person would truly be tameh. But these are people who experience the week, bathe their bodies at the end to become, you know, to move from the week on. And these people are, within this cultural framework, Tohorim. So they're not Tohorim from the ideal halachic perspective. They're not Tohorim from the ideal Beit HaMikdash, if you will, law perspective. But they are Tohorim from their perspective. So now, when we turn to Korban Pesach, we have to ask ourselves, which is more critical? That these people be Tohorim according to an ideal perspective of Parah Adumah, which we will, again, we'll get to in one moment, or that they be Tohorim and thereby also celebrate, right, the Geula, the redemption, the God's redemption of the Jewish people every year. Given the God's redemption of the Jewish people every year is the critical ritual, if you will, celebration in all of Tanakh, and given that it's not meant to be participated in a sliding or inappropriate manner, but these people feel that they are completely pure. So I'm surprised that the Tosefta says, if most of the Jewish people no longer cares about Parah Adumah, the Jewish people can offer a Korban Pesach and even enter the Azara to slaughter it, the courtyard to slaughter it, when they are technically impure because they are experientially pure. Okay, I hope that point is clear. I'm sure it is open to questions, but I hope it is clear. Let me look at one more box, explain Parah Adumah, and then I will take questions. So I've set up that Jewry, during the time of Chazal, apparently, easily post Chumban Beit HaMikdash, there is also scholarly debate about when Paraduma ceased to be used by whom. I would suggest that by the time of Chazal, it wasn't being used anymore, especially outside Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash. I think it wasn't being used even earlier. But let us say by the time of Chazal. And so, if we see this, right, then we see that the same ideas are played out. People need to become pure. People do try to become pure. They leave, at least most people try to become pure, and the community pressures everybody else who's not ready to move on to move on. And then they have the 3, 7 days and bathing. But let's jump to medieval Europe. Medieval Ashkenazic Europe is Europe which has no official ways, again, to become pure from Tumat Met. There is no Paraduma. There is no Beit HaMikdash in which to burn the ashes of a Paraduma of a red heifer. There is no way to become pure from death. So officially, everybody who has come in contact with the dead is impure. And therefore, there would be no reason to ever try to purify oneself further from death, or in any way from death, because one is already impure from death if one has ever buried a dead body or joined a funeral and carried the body and so forth. Nonetheless, what is the practice in Ashkenaz? So I look at two people from the same period, Tashbetz and the Mordechai. Tashbetz and the Mordechai are both students of Maharam Mirotenberg. The Maharam Mirotenberg is famous in history. Famous in history as the leading Gadol and Rishon of Germany, who attempted to flee Germany, was imprisoned by the emperor, and refused to be ransomed and died in prison. So if that reminds people of anybody, that is the Maharam in Rosenberg. For those who learn Gemara more, Maharam Rosenberg is the teacher of the Rush, right, the Rush printed in the back of the Gemara, who did move from Germany to Spain. So the Maharam Rosenberg had two other students other than the Rush, and those were the Tashbetz and the Mordechai. Or the Tashbetz Katan, I should say, Rishon ben Tzadok and Mordechai ben Hillel. Mordechai ben Hillel actually was killed around 1310 in some type of pogrom. But those are two of his students other than the Rush. So the Tashbetz says, Elu enetzichin etzila acharehim, a list of when people need to wash hands, after which events. Ha'olech Beit Avel, where the Mordechai says, Ha'olech ben ha-meitzim. They both provide this list, and there's two variations. One is one washes hands after leaving the house of the mourner. The other is one washes hands after having walked between the dead, i.e. after leaving the cemetery. The second one is more known to us. It's the more common one. Where people wash their hands after the cemetery, in spite of the fact that those same people who wash their hands, they'd be technically impure from the dead. Technically impure from the dead and have no way of becoming pure. But if we move away from the technical rules of Torah, Paraduma, and so forth, then these are people who are not impure from the dead. They buried whoever they buried X time ago. Right? They are living their lives as people do after death. Affected, but not tamei or mourning. And they have now gone to a cemetery, and given that they've now gone to a cemetery, they need to semi-separate from that experience. And given that in Ashkenaz, people did not just simply say, okay, let's go bathe. In Ashkenaz, bathing once a week was a big deal, which we'll come back to in one moment. But given that it was a big deal to bathe even once a week, what they did is they washed their hands. And that was their way of, if you will, washing the event behind, leaving it behind, and moving on. The phrase in English, washing my hands of X. So they wash their hands of X, and they moved on. And the Tashbetz describes that this is not merely after a cemetery, but after the negative experience of having gone to perform a mitzvah, a beautiful deed, even possibly feeling good about having done something good, which is consoling the mourners, but yet having walked out, again acknowledging death and its effects on others and the havoc that it wreaks. And then there was an approach, which is not practiced today, which was to wash hands even after leaving the house in Avel. Or to put it back into Chazal's Tumah terms, even after having come in contact with a person who came in contact with the dead. In other words, an Avatuma. Right? And a person, the Avel, who came in contact with a dead body and is now Tameh Mit. Not the dead person, but a Tameh Mit. And so anybody in contact with that person washes his or her hands. Okay, so when we turn to this, we see that in Ashkenaz, even though the laws of Tumat Mit do not apply anymore because everybody was Tameh Mit anyway, they continued washing their hands after a negative event in order to wash it away. So, what we're seeing is that there's no chok here. There is an explicable Torah law that explains how to react to death, not to be, not to be atum. Not to be, if anybody wishes to jump in and chat a word in English, I'll be happy. Not to be cut off, emotionally cut off, not to be emotionally numb, thank you very much. Not to be numb to death, definitely not to be callous to death, rather to experience, react, mourn, go through the process, and including the process of moving forward on days 3, moving forward on day 7, a source I did not give you here, and one that is violated all the time, so I keep, therefore I avoid bringing it in print, is Masechet Smachot, where it says that in the first 3 days nobody should come to comfort the mourners. They should be allowed to mourn between themselves. Classically, it's family, not merely one person. And then on the third day, the rest of the community comes. I'm sorry, let me be clearer. First 3 days, the mourners, not merely the mourners and their immediate relatives, such as spouses and so forth, those people can come. And basically, the mourners are allowed to cry. And on the third day only, the community begins arriving and comforting, which matches everything that we've seen. Today, that tends to be violated because, I guess, people need to fit comforting into their busy schedules, and so people tend to come already on the first day. Okay, so based on everything I've said, everything makes sense except for that one little point that I keep avoiding, which is the red heifer paraduma. So, I'll suggest as follows, that paraduma actually is no more than no less than everything we've said so far, which is a method of dealing with the psychological reaction. And the use of a red heifer was a specific symbol, and therefore it's not surprising that it died out, because it was a symbol that had no resonance beyond ancient Israel. What symbol am I referring to? The symbol of a bull. In the ancient Near East, the symbol for life was a white bull. The symbol for death was a black bull. Is it then surprising that a red calf is burnt? A red calf, first of all, calf, two bulls, a calf in between, younger, somehow not death, not life, in between, red. I mean, I don't think it takes much to understand that that probably refers to blood, as we will see. In the next section, when we deal with kashrut, is that a chok or not a chok? And one of the basic things the Torah forbids is blood, eating blood. Blood is connected with life. Blood is burnt here into ashes, and that's symbolic of death. And yet it's sprinkled on the person. So there is a symbol sprinkled on the person. So the main experiential thing sprinkled on the person is the cold water with the ashes. Or to put this differently, experientially, what is sprinkled on the person is cold water, again, cold spring water, fresh, powerful, with ashes, which is actually a form of soap. Ashes of animals is used for soap, which is a way of basically sprinkling the person with that, which is a form of cleaning. Again, 3 days they have not bathed. And again, this is not Ashkenaz. They used to bathe every day, or at least wash themselves. Third day that is done again. And then the person enters into water and washes it all off, and thereby cleans him or herself. So Praduma, functionally, is cold water. Cold water possibly even as a means of cleaning the ashes with the water. And symbolically, it definitely has to do with blood and life. Blood of the Praduma, the life of the with the hyssop, which sprinkles well and also was a symbol of life. So given all that symbolic power, it's obvious why the Torah in a sense commanded that this be done. But it's also kind of obvious then why Praduma, if you will, died out as a specific symbol, is replaced with the focus on cleanliness, water, and community intervening as opposed to the Kohen. To deal with more with Kohen versus community, I would then have to deal with Kuna, which I do not want to deal with at this moment. Okay, I'm now going to begin responding to questions. What about the person who brought the Praduma becoming Tame? Very nice. Okay. So, that is classically brought as an example of this being a Chok. But the person bringing the Praduma becomes Tame. Let me first explain why it's not a Chok, and then I'll try to explain why it is alluded to as a Chok. The person bringing the Praduma is a Kohen. The Kohen who brings the Praduma, or the ashes of the Praduma, and the Kohen who sprinkles the Praduma, have to be two people who have never been in contact with death. Two people who their only contact with death is when they approach it in the sense of purifying others who have been in contact with it. That's, I didn't bring those halachot, but those are halachot of Praduma. Which means when a person becomes purified, they become purified by standing opposite a person who symbolically expresses the ability to live life not connected to any negative memory and so forth of contact with death. Well, that's powerful in some ways. On the other hand, the Kohen, who has no contact with death other than being reminded of it via contact with other human beings, I would suggest that for that person, that experience is a positive, negative experience in some way. Not as negative as the actual death, but as a negative experience. So for an Ashkenaz, for example, they would wash, as we saw here, they would wash their hands after visiting the house of the mourner. It's not surprising that the Kohen who sprinkled the Tamemet, or the Kohen who even created the Efer, or the Praduma, created that which is meant to deal with death, will become impure. They don't become impure in a major way, they become impure. But that's not surprising. Okay, that is my suggested answer to you, David. Okay, I don't see any further questions, so I'm slowly scrolling up the page to give time for questions. And if that is the case, I'm going to try to show that the same can be said for Kashrut. I'm aware that it is late, and that people unfortunately have schedules that may not allow them to complete the hour. And it's my fault that we started late. Again, I apologize. I have pneumonia and I set my alarms, but apparently that didn't work. Okay, let us at least try to start. Let's turn to Kashrut and see whether this can make sense. Let's start with Dvarim. Dvarim says, Zak chazak levitzi echol adam. Be strong and avoid eating the blood, for the blood is the life, and you should not eat the life with the meat. We're in Vayikra. Every life among you shall not eat blood, and the alien among you shall not eat blood. Vayikra following Breshit, in which the pshat of Breshit, right after the Mabul with Noach, is that everybody, including non-Jews, is forbidden to eat blood. So, when we look at this, right? We can say, wow, the Torah has some type of chok, but the Torah explains itself. It says, blood is life. Blood is life. What does that mean? So unfortunately, biblical scholarship tends to tend toward the academic error of focusing on away from the experiential and to the sociological. And so there are debates whether this means that that blood is actually considered life, that blood is considered symbolic of life, and if you're critical, then are there distinctions between Dvarim and Vayikra about blood being symbolic or actual life? All these, I don't know, appear to me to be silly questions, in the sense that there's an experiential reaction here. Blood that has come from the animal, right? But no, let's do this two ways, I'm sorry. Let's imagine what it means to eat an animal with blood and an animal without blood, and to eat the blood that is pouring out of the animal. The blood is meant to be poured on the ground and covered, which I did not give you here. I'm sorry, I did not bring the full psukim. Okay, so the blood is meant to be poured on the ground and either poured on the ground and covered, or offered on the mizbeach, and it says there as an atonement. So I will actually be fitting. We'll refer to that in 1 second again. So, what does it mean to actually eat in those different ways? So imagine I eat the blood pouring out of the animal as it is dying. There would clearly be something powerful about it, I suppose, as in Voldemort drinking blood from a unicorn. But there would be something definitely negative about that experience. That's one. Imagine I eat the animal with its blood, if that's what the Torah means. Meaning don't even eat the blood that's in the animal, which we will see is a machloket tanaim. But let us say the Torah means that. But imagine eating an animal with blood and an animal without blood. An animal that's dead but has its blood in it, and I eat it. And the blood, you know, spills all over it. I will not continue further, for those who may be vegetarians. Eating an animal that way is eating an animal that is almost alive. Again, barbaric. Draining an animal of its blood and then eating it is as close as you can get to hamburgers, I guess, and steaks in a society that is making its own food. Right? The closest I can get to an animal that is no longer an animal, that is already meat, is to drain it of its blood. So either way of reading this psukim, that the psukim mean not to eat the blood that is poured out of the animal, definitely while it's dying, but even afterwards, that same blood, or not to eat the animal, not to eat the animal with its blood in it, are both understandable ways of saying it's barbaric. And that matches the fact that the Torah says in Vayikra that the blood has to be offered on the Mizbeach, as a form of atonement. Again, look at Vayikra and Dvarim in the context, and you'll see more psukim. It has to be offered as atonement. Atonement for eating the animal. Meaning, of course, we're allowed to eat animals because human beings need protein. Human beings need iron. But that doesn't mean that there isn't something problematic about it. If we understand this in this fashion, the issue of eating dam, then it's no longer a chok. Not only is it no longer a chok, it actually becomes the basis for understanding a halachav chazal that has no pasuk. Look at the Tosefta. Eva minachai noheg, noheg bivni noach. Eva minachai, the injunction against eating a limb from a live animal, applies to Bnei Noach, meaning it's a universal rule, right, that applies to everybody. Now, there is no such pasuk that says you cannot eat the limb of a live animal. You can start darshaning it in, but there's no pshat pasuk that says that. On the other hand, if we understand that the Torah forbade eating blood, and the Torah even excuse me, and the Torah even forbade anybody possibly to eat blood, as is the pshat in Bereishit, after Noah, and in Vayikra in front of us, then the most minimal standard that Chazal claim is that even if one doesn't accept the Torah, one doesn't come from that society, one does eat blood,
Okay, one is not a gerotoshav, meaning one doesn't buy into this model at all. Still, if one is a human being, with any sense of being a human being in dignity, one should not eat limb off live animal. Well, when we look at it this way, we suddenly understand where Chazal got this from. Chazal basically extrapolated what would the Torah's most minimal standard be, assuming that people did not live up to the standard of not eating blood. And that becomes one of their Noahide standards, not eating the limb of a live animal. So if we just look into what we've seen up to here, we see don't eat blood, or don't eat an animal with its blood, and don't eat the limb of a live animal as an extrapolation of a minimal standard, which matches the Torah's higher standard. Okay, that is, in a sense, the issue of being barbaric. However, the Torah continues further, and the Torah moves on to the aesthetics, which, David, this will somewhat relate to your question. Though it's not about nidah now, it's about food. Torah says, do not eat any carcass. The word the Torah uses for carcass, let's include called nevela. Nevela means disgusting, meaning nevela means disgusting. It's a word that's used in non-food situations, such as nevela sabisa. A disgusting thing was done. Do not eat anything disgusting. In other words, the word culturally for a carcass of an animal that just died on its own, that's found dead, is disgusting. So then it's understandable. The Torah forbade eating a carcass that's found. Classically, a carcass of an animal that dies on its own is either ill or has been sitting for a while. Many reasons to imagine it is disgusting. The Torah has an absolute rule. Don't eat the disgusting carcass. Okay. Next in Vayikra. So too, there are many more psukim, I didn't bring them all, but any person who eats a disgusting animal, or one that was torn, the pshat is a torn carcass. And then you watch, if you haven't seen in real life, and watch any wild animal type show, and you will see that, you know, a lion kills an animal, eats most of it, leaves some behind. A person cannot eat of that. And one who does eat of that, one who does eat of that, Baker points out, needs to wash his clothing and wash himself. If not, he bears his sin. In other words, one who has undergone this negative experience of eating such things needs to separate from it afterwards. And if one doesn't, then one bears his sin. Which takes us back to Bamidbar, which is more intensive, obviously. I didn't give you the last psukim, so if you open up Chumash later, if you recall Bamidbar, it says that a person who does not purify him or herself, again himself in the Torah's language, a person who does not purify himself from impurity from the dead, actually bears sin, and is considered as to have violated the Mikdash, even though the person never entered the Mikdash. I'm doing Pshat now, not Chazal for the moment on that topic. Merely staying impure is already considered sinful. Similarly here, a person who ate, for some reason, a carcass, either, I can't say by accident, so a person, let us say, who was traveling, who was in the desert or somewhere, and basically stumbled upon food and ate the food because they had to eat something, would then need to bathe afterwards and not merely say, okay, I had that experience, but rather needs to somehow separate it and leave it behind and not let it be part of their normal day-to-day experience. So we have now two issues when it comes to food: barbarism and disgust. And once you say that, everything else will fall into place. I see that I'm now up to the hour. So what I will do is, instead of turning to show how Chazal actually play all this out, what I'll do is, no, you know what? Okay, I would like to do something. I will skip Shkita and I will finish within 2 minutes. I will finish the rest of the sources. Assuming that what we've seen here is the issue of not acting barbarically and not acting in a disgusting manner, then I will not do a Shkita now. which I would show has no written source in the Torah of its actual details, but reflects everything we've just said, and therefore supports that this is not a chok, but rather something that unpacked and developed its own rules of how do you kill ethically, and humanely and dignified. I wanted to skip to the next sources. First, about eating meat. Sifrei Devarim, Elazar ben Azariah Omer, Ba'katuv Lelevatcha Derecheret Shelo Yochal Adam Basar Ela Letevon. A person should not eat meat except when they have a craving. This source says that only when a person truly, truly, truly has a craving for meat, only when the body calls for meat, only when the body suddenly needs meat, should they face the issue of actually eating a dead animal. Now, I'm a person who eats meat, and I know today it's a lot easier to eat. You eat a burger, you eat whatever, it doesn't look like meat anymore. So that would be a counter-argument of why we feel comfortable eating meat, because it doesn't look like the animal. But Rabbi Ezra ben Yaakov Zaria's argument was, and maybe only in his day when they had more direct contact with the dead animal, that would be already a psak debate. But his argument is, no, the Torah is saying don't eat animals. They're also alive, they also are dead, they're also corpses. So we need to eat them. Eat them when you need to. Don't eat them otherwise. That's one extrapolation from the Torah. Another one showing this is not a chok is an amazing line by Ravi Bar Abaye, who basically takes the Torah's law, applies it, extends it everywhere, and I think doesn't distort a thing, but actually follow the Torah truthfully. Amar Abibi Bar Abaye, Haiman Neshate Bekarne De Umna, Ka'avar Mishum, Lo Tishaktsu. A person who takes a bloodletter's horn and drinks from it, as in fills it with water, not blood, fills it with water and drinks from it, violates, do not disgust yourselves. Meaning, Aviva Barabai came along and said, I get it. The Torah says, don't do anything disgusting. Right? Don't do anything barbaric. There's certain ways to act in life. So I can't come along and say, oh, look, here's a bloodletter's horn. It's shaped just right. Let's fill it with water. I'm thirsty, and I'll drink from it. That would be similar to my deciding to do a mitzvah on Shabbat and walk a long distance to visit somebody in the hospital on a hot summer day. And I finally arrive at the hospital, and I come to visit the person, and I do this mitzvah, and it's great, but I'm really, really, really thirsty. So I pull out a sanitized bedpan, which is sanitized, and I drink from it. At that point, I believe one would be violating, right, Rabbi Barabai's, and the Torah's point of, do not act in a disgusting fashion. Okay, so Rabbi Barabai basically summarized the Torah's concerns. Elizabeth and Benaziah actually took them seriously and extrapolated, therefore do not eat meat except when necessary. In other words, we can now go through all the halachot of kashrut as regards animals, not as regards truma and so forth, and discover that they're all about not being barbaric and not being disgusting, not acting in a disgusting fashion. What I can do next week is maybe take out a few moments and explain Shechita in this fashion, the famous Midrash, possibly, but we'll have to see about time, in which Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says that the dead do not impurify, the water does not purify, it is all a decree by God, which Rav Soloveitchik used to say that there are no reasons for the mitzvot, and I would argue it's just the opposite. The dead don't impurify. The water does not purify. There is no metaphysical reality. If you read the story, you'll see it's dealing with metaphysics, witches, magic. It's not metaphysical. It's God's decree of this is how one should react to death and life. It's psychological. It's not metaphysical, it's psychological. It's God's chok and not some metaphysics beyond God. As well, so Soloveitchik suggested that this story had a different purpose. If somebody can tell me how to put things up in writing, I can actually put up sources I did not refer to, such as explaining why chok developed this concept of chok, as in inexplicable during the period of Byzantium, and possibly some of the points I skipped, in which case next week we would be able to move on already to the next topic of seeing that Shabbat can make sense as not merely a myriad of strange laws. So I'm willing to put that up in some way if we can all agree on a site in which I can put it up, or a way in which I can reach everybody and let everybody know that I've put them up on that site, on the ETM site. There's a site there where I can put up files, according to Bill. Okay, if that is the case, I will find out, and I will put up material. Okay, so I'll put up material again. I assume now I will try to rest shortly, but I will put them up, Bezat Hashem, before Shabbat. Okay, I will now answer David's question, and since I am over the time limit, anybody who feels that they need to leave, please, I will not feel free, I will not be insulted. Those who can listen to each other and follow, and thank you, Bill, those who can listen to each other and follow and learn from each other, because that's often how some of the better questions and points come up, by people's questions, more than what I've decided to teach, then feel free to stay on. David. You asked, how do we understand Tumat Zav and Tumat Nida? So Tumat Zav and Zavar are actually easier. Very easy, in the sense that Tumat Zav and Zavar are connected to illness. The Torah says a unusual condition, and one that continues for 3 days and so forth. Or by the Zava, it's a woman who is not really having her period, but rather suffering some type of uterine illness. And is therefore in a problematic situation. And the person is considered pure only when they've been cured, meaning 7 days have passed, their body is fine, their body has not repeated the symptoms. In that case, the person is considered pure. What happens during the time when the person is impure? Well, a natural reaction to contagion, and does not depend upon germs. People were always aware of contagion in some form or another. Sometimes better aware, sometimes mistakenly aware. For example, medieval doctors used to wear masks, long masks, like a bird face, in which they would put spices in the beak so that it would purify the air that they would breathe so that it would not become contaminated by the plague. Naturally, that did not work, but it was an attempt to purify the air because they realized that it spread without contact. So there was fear of contagion. And that makes sense. Then the Zohar says, anybody who sits on this man or woman's bed and seat, in which the blood or the gonorrheal, comes out of the body, not just the illness. I don't know what it's called. So anything in which one would sit, would become impure, possibly even touching the person, definitely the spit from the person. All that makes sense in terms of tumah. So Zav and Zavar are actually easier. Nida is a topic which I am planning on writing up after teaching it for several years, Bi'iyun, to both men and women. Bi'iyun meaning on a svicha level. Learning it in depth. To keep it simple for the moment and not get my head chopped off in this forum where I do not know everybody. Nida, I think, is a reaction both to the aesthetics and to the fact that classically, in an ancient society, a higher percentage of women would also feel physically incapacitated to some degree when having their period. So Nida was a reflection that there is a person, the opposite one, who is ill to some degree, in a normal way, but ill to some degree, and also aesthetically is bleeding, and not merely bleeding as from a cut, but it's bleeding menstrual blood, which, again, I assume people know, since it was asked, which smells differently, because it's the whole uterine lining, it's not merely blood, right? And so there is actually a reaction, given male choice between a female that is menstruating, a female that is not menstruating, the female that is not menstruating is considered a more attractive option. Nothing to do with halacha in terms of choice of a mating partner, if you will, on a merely temporary level. Okay? And so basically there's a reaction to the negative phenomena, aesthetics, if you will, of Nida. And then the Torah doesn't make that big a deal of it. We look at the Torah says that some, if the couple had sex, actually, during this time, in which most, and when I say most, I mean overwhelming majority of women do not want to have sex at all. Lowest is the time of desire for sex. At a time when most women, especially then, were in pain. A time when aesthetically, this is not the highest time of attraction, even for the man toward the woman and so forth. Desire to have sex at that point, or having sex at that point, would make the man tame. Yes, for the maximum time that a woman could have had a period, which the Torah says is 7 days. Beyond that, the Torah begins worrying that that's already not a period. Maybe it's too much, maybe she's ill, and so forth. 7 days, which is a nice margin of safety. Most women's periods are not 7 days. So the Torah says that there is a tuma of a nida, which again I think is straightforward in that sense. I'm not discussing now nida as in everything that developed afterwards, creating a longer period of separation between a man and his wife, you know, holiness through separation, trying to cut down on the number of children possibly later. All these things occur among urban Jewry, of basically adding a larger time of separation between a husband and wife beyond the time of her period, or beyond Torah Shu'al Peh's understanding that it's an automatic week. Okay? I'm not getting into that now. The Torah's Pshat, I believe, is up to a week, and Torah Shu'al Peh's understanding is that it is a full week for every woman, no distinction, no pressure on any woman to have sex earlier. 1 week given, safe margin, includes all women and includes even the day or two after the period, which for some women is also not a comfortable time to have sex. So Torah Shu'al Peh understands that the Torah means 1 week and not merely up to a week. And that's all I've discussed so far. Any other questions? Or if I was not clear? Okay, you're welcome, David. I do not see any questions from anybody else. Though I see that people have their mics on tonight. Thank you very much, even though nobody spoke. But thank you very much. My pleasure. Again, I apologize for my delay. My alarms were set. And next week, I assume I will not have pneumonia, and we will be on. Thank you very much to all. Yes, have good evenings ahead of you, and I will see you all next week. And to the person who sent me the private message, I can't figure it out right now. I would talk in a moment if this person, if you want to reach me through Skype. Okay. Thank you. Have a good week.